go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Good hit.
The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars. Every nation has the right to self-defense under the United Nations Charter. Why shouldn't Israel exercise it?
Meet Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. I am Mark Levine, the host of The Inside Scoop. Did you see Barack Obama's second press conference today? I thought it was masterful. I think there's a reason why the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up the highest in the last 2 days it's done in more than 20 years. Barack Obama presented his economic team, perhaps the best choice, I think, for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, someone who is currently the chairman of the Federal Reserve in New York, head of the New York Bank, someone who's been watching this crisis for quite a long time and who's been warning the current president of this crisis for a long time. His warnings have been ignored. He was the one who was saying we have to regulate these complex derivative credit swaps, and no one seemed to understand the same thing that brought our economy downhill. Barack Obama came out there. He presented his plan. He showed his economic staff. But more importantly, he made clear that this is a crisis that, first of all, is going to be deep. This is going to be the worst since the Great Depression, but that he had a handle on it, not just monetary policy, not just financial policy, but also taking care of Main Street, as he calls it, middle America, those of us ordinary Americans who are really the ones who fundamentally keep the economy strong. This hour, I want to talk about not just the crisis we're in, but the way out of the economic crisis. What is it that we have to do? What kind of stimulus package do we need? What should we do with regard to the auto companies? Do you think they should be bailed out? If so, how? What should the unions do? Should they tighten their belts further? Or are workers actually our path out of this crisis? If you didn't see the press conference, I'm going to play for you a little bit about it right now to give you an idea of what President-elect Barack Obama had to say.
You cannot have a thriving Wall Street without a thriving Main Street. That in this country we rise or fall as one nation, as one people. Today, Vice President-elect Biden and I are pleased to announce the nomination of 4 individuals who meet these criteria to lead our economic team. Timothy Geithner as Secretary of Treasury, Lawrence Summers as the Director of our National Economic Council, Christina Romer as Chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and Melody Barnes as Director of the Domestic Policy Council. Having served in senior roles at Treasury, the IMF, and the New York Fed, Tim Geithner offers not just extensive experience shaping economic policy and managing financial markets, he also has an unparalleled understanding of our current economic crisis in all of its depth, complexity, and urgency. Tim will waste no time getting up to speed. He will start his first day on the job with a unique insight into the failures of today's markets and a clear vision of the steps we must take to revive them. The reality is that the economic crisis we face is no longer just an American crisis. It's a global crisis, and we will need to reach out to countries around the world to craft a global response. Tim's extensive international experience
makes him uniquely suited to do that work. Growing up partly in Africa and having lived and worked throughout Asia, having served as Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs, one of the many roles in the international arena, and having studied both Chinese and Japanese, Tim understands the language of today's international markets in more ways than one. Tim served with distinction under both Democrats and Republicans, and has a long history of working comfortably and as an honest broker on both sides of the aisle. With stellar performances and outstanding results at every stage of his career, Tim has earned the confidence and respect of business, financial, and community leaders, members of Congress, and political leaders around the world. And I know he will do so once again as America's next Treasury Secretary, the chief economic spokesman for my administration.
I wanted to play that at length because I think it's important that you get to know who this guy is. Barack Obama didn't choose someone very famous to be Treasury Secretary. He chose the best person to be Treasury Secretary. I have a lot of confidence in Tim Geithner. For one thing, he is someone who sounded the alarm early. He is someone who understood that runaway, rampant corporate capitalism, it's not even really capitalism, it's really cronyism, is the kind of thing that is leading us to economic disaster, he said last year and the year before, and no one listened to him. And yet he's a very respectable figure, partly because he doesn't stand out politically. He doesn't grandstand. He's not someone who has gone repeatedly before the public. He's tried very hard to work within the system. Tim Geithner is a young man. He's about Barack Obama's age, about 47, 48 years old. But he's someone who understands this necessity and someone who's worked in the current administration as a nonpartisan head of the Federal Reserve in New York to work out solutions. In fact, it was Tim Geithner who spent all weekend long saving Citibank, something which I think had to be done because I recognize that this kind of thing, a bank failure of this magnitude, Citibank used to be the largest bank in America, it's one of the largest banks in the world, is the kind of thing that could make the entire economy fall apart. Now, many people have said the most important cabinet position that Barack Obama had to fill was Treasury Secretary. Now, traditionally, it might be Secretary of State, and it looks like it's going to be Hillary Clinton for the job. But in this economy, at this time, when we are facing the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression, it's important to have someone who doesn't grandstand. Important to have someone who understands basic economics, but who's forward-thinking enough to really think outside the box and look at solutions that need to be done. One of the things that I found throughout this press conference, and I want to hear what you thought about it too, by the way, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, or you can call locally at the number on your screen. One of the things that I thought about this, Tim Geithner, and about really the whole press conference, is that Barack Obama is showing he's not a man who's going to say something, ideologically stick with it, whether it's good or bad or smart or not smart. This is a dramatic difference from the current president. As most of you know, George W. Bush, our current president, was the kind of president who basically made a decision, whether he did it for his guts or for ideological reasons or whatever, and stuck with that decision. He said, we're going to go to Iraq, and he's not going to look. He's not going to second guess. If you've read Bob Woodward's new book, you know that even when all the generals were telling him this is a bad idea, President Bush stuck with it because he was afraid that if he changed his mind, he would look weak. What Barack Obama shows is that someone who's willing to be flexible, willing to look at oncoming events and make decisions that make sense at that time, that kind of flexibility is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. Republicans might try to push that as flip-flopping, but actually, what I think Barack Obama is saying is, look, I don't know what the situation is going to be on January 20th, 2008. The reporters, we're going to play some of this, pressed him as to what would be the size of his package, his economic stimulus package. And he said, look, I'm going to have to see. I'm going to talk with my economic team. I'm going to talk with members of Congress. Barack Obama understands that he has no power, official power, until January 20th, 2009. But he's preparing to hit the ground running, as he said, doing a terrific idea. The Congress is getting ready to present him a package that will be ready for him to sign on Inauguration Day. Now, why is this? Why do we have to wait till January? Well, it's very simple. The Constitution of the United States, which I keep right here, makes very clear that there are 2 days to that in the Constitution as to when there is a transition. We can go over here if you want. There we are. There are 2 days. One is the day when Congress has its transition, and the other is the day when the president has its transition. Congress, according to the Constitution, comes into office on January 3rd. The president on January 20th. Now, there may well be a lame duck session of Congress. A lame duck session, of course, is a Congress that's left over from the prior session. In other words, a lame duck, it has an expression because the idea is that this is a politician that have as much power as a lame duck. But it's an old expression, and it means basically after an election and prior to the new people coming in. Currently, Congress is very closely divided, with 51 Democrats, really 49 Democrats and two independents, including Joe Lieberman, who's kind of a shaky Democrat, and a smaller majority in the House. And this Congress went to the president. In fact, we know that Barack Obama talked with President Bush and said, we need a massive stimulus package. We need to help ordinary Americans. We need to help Main Street. And there's a reason why, not just politically, but economically, it's a great idea. I want to talk about that this hour. And George Bush said no. He said, I'll do it only if you give me what I want. Give me the Colombian Free Trade Agreement. Help me help the big corporations move jobs out of the United States into Colombia, a government that, let's face it, has its own problems with not really respecting human rights the way it should. Barack Obama said no. He said, I'm not negotiating with you. You're a lame duck. Bush said, hey, you want a package in December? You got to do it my way. I will let the American people suffer, George Bush said. I will allow Americans to be fired. Millions of jobs will be lost. The stock market will crash. If you don't give me this little thing I want, the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, sorry, I'm not going to help you. Well, Barack Obama, to his credit, a lot of people don't think he's tough. This young president-elect said, no deal. He said, no deal. Mr. President, we're going to hit the ground running in January. If you don't do it our way in December, we're going to do it our way in January. So using this part of the Constitution, the Congress will convene on January 3rd with a substantial Democratic majority, at least 58 Senate seats, possibly 59. In fact, I think 59 is quite likely, looking how Minnesota recount's going, even conceivably 60 if we win the runoff election in Georgia December 2nd. I don't think that's going to happen. But Democrats will be in control. Even when President Bush is in office from January 3rd to January 20th, Democrats will have strong control of Congress. They can pass a bill in both the Senate and the House, a massive stimulus package, and hit the ground running and literally present that bill to Barack Obama on Inauguration Day. And I, for one, would love to see him up there, be inaugurated, give his massive speech. And in the middle of that speech, wouldn't it be great if he would say, hand me the bill, and in the middle of the speech, say, I am today signing, and signed right up there on the podium to show that within minutes of becoming President of the United States, this is a president in charge. So I don't know if he's going to take my advice, but President-elect Obama, you hear me? What great symbolism would that be? You'd be the first president in United States history to, in the middle of your inauguration speech, make a bill into law. What is that law? That law is a massive economic stimulus package, massive government spending, exactly the kind of thing the Republicans say is harmful to the nation. And let me tell you something. In normal times, I am a fiscal conservative, as most Democrats are. As you may well know, during the entire reign of the Republican Congress, we had Republicans insisting on massive, massive budget deficits. The reason we have the largest deficit ever in American history is because Republicans believe in spending without taxing, in borrowing lots of money from China and Saudi Arabia to make sure that they can pay, for example, for the Iraq War now so that our children have to pay for it later. The Republicans understood that Americans didn't want to pay for the Iraq War, so they decided to push that on our children and grandchildren. Normally, I'm a fiscal conservative. The Democrats, in fact, were the ones that did the pay-as-you-go policy. You may know that. The idea is that if you're going to spend money on something, you have to have the money in the budget to pay for it. And that is right in normal years. But you know what? When you're heading to the greatest depression since the Great Depression, all rules are thrown out the window. This is a difficult time, but it's not a crisis, it's an opportunity. And it's an opportunity to enact legislation to help Americans for years to come. Infrastructure, healthcare, education. There's a time when there should be big spending, and that time is now. Give me a call, let me know if you agree. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
Osama bin Laden calls getting nuclear weapons a religious duty.
Today, materials that can be used to make nuclear weapons are stored in more than 40 countries.
Sometimes protected by just a chain-link fence.
Yet not enough is being done to lock down these materials
before terrorists steal them. Why did we learn all this?
My mother.
My son.
My sister-in-law.
Were all murdered September 11th.
Help protect America.
Together we can. Please join us.
The stem cell issue is being debated throughout the country. Truth is, most everyone has an opinion, even if they don't know the facts.
Let's stop arguing and start really understanding the potential of stem cell research.
For us and for millions of Americans living with disabilities, get the facts.
Call 1-877-842-3442.
It is going to be from the Stem Cell Research Foundation. That is necessary to get this economy back on track. I don't want to get into numbers right now. It is going to be, I want to see it enacted. We have a consensus, which is pretty rare. I want to see it enacted.
They're stronger when we are united.
Remember what that flag you're waving stands for.
One nation under God.
Indivisible.
With liberty.
And justice.
I want to see it enacted.
In America, there's either room for everyone, or it's not America.
Don't pick the wrong fight.
Let's keep America land of the free.
Stop the hate.
Planning a home renovation? Put this at the top of your to-do list.
Because after 10 years, none of you are protected against tetanus and another potentially fatal disease, diphtheria.
A minor injury, such as a cut or a scrape, can put you at risk for a tetanus infection.
And while safety gear offers some protection, an up-to-date vaccination called the TD booster is the best insurance against tetanus.
So get the TD booster. If it's been 10, do it again.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. After the election of 1932, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, President-elect, because he was elected in November 1932, but he didn't take office until March of 1933. Those 4 months were some of the worst economic months in American history. President Hoover decided to just wait it out. In fact, at that time, he cut back on spending. He actually made the economy smaller at a time when most Americans were suffering. And he desperately asked Franklin Delano Roosevelt to stand with him in doing this, and Roosevelt said, no deal, no deal. You're president, you do it your way. When I come in, I'm going to do it my way. Well, President-elect Obama is hitting the ground running. He has trying to work with the current administration to the extent he can. But the current administration does not want to help out ordinary Americans. It only wants to help out Wall Street. It only wants to help out the banks, and that's necessary. I grant that that is necessary. In fact, one of the things I have to do is praise John McCain, not something I do often, for recognizing that the bailout bill was a necessary evil. He could have gone against it. He could have said no. That might have helped him in his election campaign with Americans not understanding it if he demagogued the issue. But instead, the economy would be, I think, far worse off than it is today. But Barack Obama and the Democrats understand we need more than just the question of helping out Wall Street, but also helping out Main Street. We need a tremendous stimulus package. Here is how Barack Obama responded when asked a question about that package just today.
I want to see it enacted right away. It is going to be of a size and scope that is necessary to get this economy back on track. I don't want to get into numbers right now. Part of the task of this economic team behind me is to help shape the details of that plan in consultation with Congress, the Federal Reserve, and businesses and thinkers across the country. But I think the most important thing to recognize is that we have a consensus, which is pretty rare, between conservative economists and liberal economists, that we need a big stimulus package that will jolt the economy back into shape and that is focused on the 2.5 million jobs that I intend to create during the first part of my administration. We have to put people back to work. Now, that runs in parallel with making sure that our financial system is stable, and so we're going to have to do more than one thing at a time. But across the board, people believe that this stimulus is critical. And the first job of my economic team is to shape that economic stimulus package so that it is delivering on the 2.5 million jobs that we talked about and is also providing a down payment on the long-term strategies we need in terms of making this economy work for all Americans. That means we have to invest in clean energy. We're going to have to invest in the systems in our in healthcare that can reduce costs for families and for businesses. It means that we're going to have to invest in the education system to ensure that we're competitive over the 21st century. So not only do I want the stimulus package to deal with the immediate crisis, I want it also to lay the groundwork for long-term sustained economic growth.
This, as I said, is not just a crisis, but an opportunity. It's an opportunity because generally, in most times, we have to be careful about the public fisc, right? Generally, we should be fiscally conservative. I have long talked about Joseph's dream in the Bible. Do you remember that dream? Joseph interprets actually the Pharaoh's dream. The Pharaoh dreams of the seven fat cows and then the seven lean cows, which devour the seven fat cows. The story of Pharaoh's dream that Joseph interprets is that when you have good years, because these seven cows represent seven good agricultural years in the land of Egypt, you have to save grain for the bad years so that people can eat later. The point is that any economist will tell you, conservative or liberal, Barack Obama is absolutely right about this, that in good times, you need to run budget surpluses, despite the fact that what George Bush did when we had a small economic boom in the O's, and not like the boom we had in the 90s under Bill Clinton, but the boom, you know, that we had in 03, 04, 05, 06, that's the time when you need a surplus. That's the time when you shouldn't have tax cuts to the super rich. That's the time when you shouldn't be spending money on Iraq that you don't pay for. You save then for the lean times. But you see, there's two debates in Washington. And most people in Washington understand what I think a lot of people in America don't understand, that there's two separate issues. One is the level of spending. How much of a budget deficit should you run? And the other is where the spending should go. Now, Republicans and Democrats make you think that they're only caring about the budget deficit. Republicans particularly say, we hate government spending. Well, that's not true. Republicans love government spending. They love government spending on war. They love government spending on Halliburton. They love government spending on extremely rich people, on corporations, tax cuts for oil companies, making sure that, for example, Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq can hand out tractor trailers full of cash, 18 tractor trailers containing $8 billion of cash, handing it out to all the people who we think will help out George Bush. And if not, well, they'll just mislead us on our intelligence. These are the things Republicans want to spend money on, bridges to nowhere, for example. It's not that they don't like spending. They want spending on their priorities. Democrats like spending, too, but they want it spending on their priorities. Health care for the middle class, making sure that children can go to college, even children without rich parents, Democrats think should have an opportunity to go to college. Democrats think that we need to get off our addiction to foreign oil. Republicans believe in oil. Drill, baby, drill. They want to make sure that our economy is tied to oil for the next two centuries. Democrats say no. Oil not only is harmful to the environment, doesn't cause global warming only, though that's certainly true, but also makes us indebted to the same dictators in Saudi Arabia and China and Venezuela and Iran, the same dictators that the Republicans are trying to overthrow, but at the same time is making us their indebted servants. So Democrats believe, for example, in spending money on American infrastructure. You know, building Iraqi bridges is not a bad thing, but building bridges in Minneapolis is more important. Now, Republicans in traditional years say, sounds good, but health care is too expensive. Social Security, too expensive. Medicare, education, having an alternative energy, wind, solar energy, it's too expensive. We need to spend the money on war. We need to spend the money on Iraq, on our dictators in Iraq, the people we control there. We need to spend the money on Halliburton and oil companies. We need to spend money on bridges to small islands where no one lives. And there's this debate, and they say you're spending too much money. What Barack Obama recognizes is that this year, like 1933, like Franklin Roosevelt, he can do both. Because economists will tell you that even though it's going to cause a ballooning deficit, and I admit that it will, we need massive spending now more than at any time since the New Deal. We need a new deal. Only by a massive jolt to the economy will we get people moving again. Will we get jobs? Will we get the spending? Will we get the kind of confidence we need in our markets to have people start lending again? Will this cause a massive deficit? It will. When we have good times again, we're going to have to pay it back. But one terrific reason why it's great that John McCain is not our president-elect is John McCain believed in the exact same economics as Herbert Hoover. John McCain believed in the middle of a Great Depression that you constrict the economy, that you cut government spending, that you make the economy smaller, that you, for example, make people pay more for health care, more for the education and all the general things that middle class is already suffering on. And by doing that, by making all Americans poor, he thinks he's going to help the budget. Barack Obama understands that this is a time when conservatives and liberals alike understand we need massive government spending. Now, don't think the Democrats always support massive government spending. We don't. You know, for example, in both the Clinton years and the Bush years, it was Democrats that were putting the brakes on spending while Republicans wanted to do a lot. This isn't about the level of spending. It's about where the spending goes. And because every economist in America, conservative and liberal alike, Barack Obama's right about this, believes that in an emergency, and we're in an emergency, we need massive government spending. As a Democrat, he can decide where that spending goes to. It can go to health care. It can go to education. It can go to green energy. The idea that, yes, we need wind and solar, clean energy. And it can go to the hybrid car, the fuel cell, maybe even as Brazil did. They have their cars run on sugar cane. Whatever it is, Barack Obama understands that these are the priorities. Building bridges, for example. The same thing that FDR did back in the New Deal. Building infrastructure that can last for a generation. You've seen it, so have I. We've seen the crumbling roadways. We've seen it all across our nation, not just in the Washington, D.C. area. We've seen it in the bridge that fell apart in Minnesota to people's deaths. This is the kind of thing where you not only spend the money we need to spend, but spend it on something lasting. John Maynard Keynes, the economist of the 1930s, said that if you have an economy like they had, where there's simply not enough demand, where the whole economy is collapsing, where there's a fear of deflation, actually, as there is now, as it was in the 1930s, you could pay people to dig ditches. You could put money underground, pay people to dig ditches to get that money, and that would be better for the economy than what Herbert Hoover was doing. And Keynes was right. And interestingly, I don't know a single economist that disagrees. I know some Republicans that disagree, but I don't know any economists that disagree. We need massive spending, and the best part is, if we spend it on the right thing, if we spend it on infrastructure, if we spend it on bridges and highways and schools and roads, if we spend it on the kind of thing that can last 30, 40, 50 years from now, on national parks, on clean energy, this is the kind of thing that can help Americans for a generation to come. This isn't money that's thrown away. This is money that we can use for the future. This is a tremendous opportunity. And I know the Democratic Congress will hit the ground running. They will come in on January 3rd. They will get the bill in place. There will be enough of them to avoid any Republican filibuster, I think. And then on January 20th, 2009, Barack Obama is going to sign legislation. The largest stimulus package since the New Deal will have a new deal in America. That's the only way to get us out of the economy and help us for the future. When we come back, I want to talk about the big three automakers. Should we bail them out? They came to Washington. They had their hands out. Should we help them? Do they even know what they're doing? We'll be right back after this.
Around the world, one out of every three women will be beaten or otherwise abused in their lifetime, often by a family member or loved one. A future free from violence. It's all she's ever wished for.
Did you know you had the power to stop children from joining gangs? You can help a father find a job and home for his family. You can assist a woman who can't afford the medicine she needs to live and the home she can't live without. You can choose to make a difference in our community. Support Volunteers of America, and you can help improve the lives of nearly 2 million Americans each year with programs and services that help individuals and families overcome their challenges to become as independent as possible. Support the programs that are working in our community. Contact Volunteers of America today. Call 1-800-899-0089.
For some folks, saving for the future is easy. But for you, it might take a little more effort.
Saving for your future is your responsibility. And there's a lot to save for.
I never thought of that.
Like your child's education, perhaps uncovered medical expenses, or just to be sure you can live the way you want when you retire. The time is now to save for tomorrow. Save now or work forever. The choice is yours. Choose to save.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. We're talking about the way out of the economic crisis, what President-elect Barack Obama is doing. We also want to talk about what Congress is doing. Did you see the hearing before the House Financial Services Committee where the big three automakers, their CEOs of Chrysler, Ford, and GM, came and tried to ask Congress for money? You know, I don't know if you saw it, the entire 2-3 hour hearing, but I do know that Saturday Night Live managed to capture on camera the essence of what that hearing was all about.
Coverage of the House Financial Services Committee, where hearings on the proposed bailout for the big three auto companies are about to begin.
Good evening. As you know, these hearings on the proposed financial aid package for the big three automakers have been set to resume December 2nd. But when Mr. Wagoner, Mr. Nardelli, and Mr. Mullally asked if they could come back from Detroit and meet today, 10 days early, I considered that an impressive sign of good faith and granted their request. Now, you'll recall this committee had asked these gentlemen to come up with a specific, detailed proposal regarding the aid package by December 2nd. But now, I understand, we'll hear that proposal today. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we begin, I'd like to apologize to the committee for the fact that we arrived here in Washington so late. As many of you know, instead of flying, the three of us decided to drive here from Detroit. But we had car trouble. I was going to drive my 2009 Cadillac XLRV, a model we at GM are very proud of, but every time I tried to start it, I just got a powerful electric shock, and the upholstery would catch on fire. Bond here wanted to come in his new Chrysler 300, but the brakes, steering, transmission, and engine all went out. Also, I believe the windshield came off? Yeah. So we all piled into Alan's brand new Ford Fiesta, which worked out pretty well, except that when you turned on the lights, the heater and car alarm would come on. Plus, the GPS system wasn't working too well, and we were just outside of St. Louis when we figured that out. But long story short, we found a Radio Shack, got a new GPS, and we are here.
Well, Mr. Wagoner, we're just glad you arrived safely. Now, please tell us your proposal regarding the aid package.
Sure, of course. As you can see, Mr. Chairman, this proposal is specific, it is detailed, and it is both short and long range. Now, assuming we receive the $25 billion in aid sometime this weekend, on January 1st, 2009, we will request another $25 billion. Then on June 15th, we will ask for $50 billion. On September 30th, another $50 billion. Then, provided there's a rebound in new car sales, on December 15th, $100 billion. If you know, I don't want to bore you with the rest. It's all there in the handouts that you've received. I welcome your questions.
Now, Mr. Wagoner, as I look over your proposal, it seems like just a list of dates covering the next 5 years and an amount of federal money you'll be asking for on those dates.
Exactly. Is this not what you had in mind?
No, it isn't.
Mr. Chairman, we worked really hard on this.
The chair recognizes the gentlelady from New York.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I discussed a few days ago, my constituents and I are very concerned about our nation's dependence on foreign oil. Now, a few years ago, this Congress passed legislation mandating 200 miles per gallon cars by 2015. So we've done our part. And my question question is, and I'll ask you, Mr. Nardelli, what is Chrysler doing about making more fuel-efficient cars?
I don't know. But it's interesting you mention that. Have you noticed how expensive gas is these days? On the drive here from Detroit, we couldn't believe it. It was more than $2.50 a gallon.
One place we saw $3 a gallon. I kid you not.
Actually, about 6 months ago, it was more than $4.
Get out of here.
Chair recognizes the gentleman from North Carolina, Mr. Jones.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wagner, according to your testimony earlier in the week, for every car General Motors sells, it loses $2,500. Now, if that's the case, just how are you going to turn your company around?
Well, I guess we'll just have to sell more cars. Oh, no, wait. Forget that. I don't know.
The average family for my district lives on less than $40,000 a year. Now, that's just... You know, that's just, how do I get back to my constituents and explain to them that we're taking $25 billion of their tax money to bail out an industry so badly mismanaged?
Well, can't you just lie to them?
What?
Well, tell them you didn't give us the money. They're not going to find out.
Okay, first of all, listen, I don't lie to my constituents. The second, right now, we're on television.
Congressman, no one watches C-SPAN.
I'd like to second my colleague's idea about lying to your constituents. No one watches C-SPAN.
You could run a snuff film on C-SPAN, nobody would notice.
Yeah, if I could direct your attention to this chart.
All right, now look, I'm not interested in any chart, all right? I don't care who's watching, and I'm not going to lie to my constituents, and I'm deeply disappointed by your performance here today.
I'm just telling you, no one watches C-SPAN.
Stop saying that.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from New York.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Unlike my friend from North Carolina, I'm sympathetic to your problem. But first, I need some answers. 2 months ago, I bought a Chevy Avalanche. And whenever I try to start it, the battery's dead, so I have to get a jump. But even after driving around all day, if I turn off the car, it won't start again. So I have to leave it running 24 hours a day. I've been told it's because when I turn off the car, the air conditioner starts up and drains the battery.
Congressman, let me interrupt, if I may. I think I know your problem here. Your car is what we at Ford call a lemon. And believe me, there's nothing you can do about it.
Uh-huh.
But if it's any comfort, you are not alone. Just at Ford, we've got millions and millions of lemons on the road.
Yeah. At GM, we have a whole plant that produces nothing but lemons.
So do we.
I really appreciate your honesty. I'm going to vote for the bailout, because I'm a union man.
The chair is happy to recognize our friend from New York, Mr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I would really like to help you. I think we all would. But your testimony here today does not inspire confidence, and I don't see how we could justify this bailout by taxpayers.
Congressman, with all due respect, we are not talking about a gift or a subsidy. We are talking about a loan.
A loan on which you will mostly certainly default.
Yes.
I believe that concludes these hearings. I have nothing more to add except to stress what I've already said many times. Detroit needs to build not only safer cars and more fuel-efficient cars, but gayer cars. You know, like the Mini Cooper. I think they're adorable. Anyway, live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Well, what can I say? Sometimes many a truth is said in jest, and Saturday Night Live really captured a lot of what happened at that hearing. I saw a lot of the hearing, and what you saw, with some excesses for comedy, really was what happened at that hearing. You had members of Congress say, hey, we want to help you, we support the car industry, but we want to know what to do. I mean, we want to help out all those many, many workers that are... suffering, right? All the jobs, all the millions of people in plants, all the people in the suppliers, all the people that make parts. There's millions of American workers in the auto industry that would suffer, but you got to do better than that. You've got to give us a plan. You've got to give us a way out. And those car people weren't giving a way out. They weren't suggesting moving to hybrids or fuel cells, and frankly, they were kind of tone deaf in the sense that they all took corporate jets to appear at the hearing when, frankly, a lot of Americans are saying, why couldn't you drive? Why couldn't you use your cars? Or why couldn't you at least fly, maybe even first class? Why did you need the corporate jets? So we're at sort of a crossroads here. The Democratic Congress is saying to the big three automakers, we want to help you, but you've got to help us. And they have given them until December 2nd to come up with the right plan. But what is the right plan? What is it that workers need to do? How is it that we can help the big three, help the automakers succeed, but at the same time care for all the people that matter, all the people that work for the industry? And what is the role of unions? You heard that one congressman say, I'm a union man. I want to help out the auto industry. But is the management kind of holding workers over as hostages as it is? Are they holding workers hostages? Are they trying to take jobs at workers' expense? I invited today Shannon Sullivan. Now, Shannon Sullivan is a labor representative. She represents a labor union. But she also recognizes that sometimes you have to help out big management, big companies at the same time to help save them. And the question for me, though, I want to ask you that question, and I want to move on to the question of what should be the role of unions in a new presidential administration. Shannon Sullivan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you so much.
Let me just start on the GM bailout just briefly. I assume that workers, you have the management, they're coming on these corporate jets, they're flying in, they're not really getting any answers here, and yet there are real problems in the industry. The workers need help. So do you support the Congress saying to these management, you got to come up with a solution, you've got to show us your cards, if you will, before we give you money?
Oh, absolutely. With any of the restructuring of any of the companies where they've given money to the banks or the financial firms, I think it's been that they have to put forward a solid plan in order to get any sort of money. And it only makes sense that if they need to restructure either their business plan, the making of their cars, make them more fuel efficient, usable for the future generations, it absolutely should go hand in hand with getting some money.
Let's talk about the unions here, because I know that there are particularly people on the right, Rush Limbaugh, mm-hmm. complaining that the real problem that we face, the real financial problem, this entire crisis is because union workers at these big auto companies do have decent health care, do have decent pensions. It's fascinating to me because, a lot of the New Deal is going back to the 1930s. Yeah. And a lot of Republicans insisted in Roosevelt's era and Truman's era that it's not the role of government to provide pensions. It's not the role of government to provide health care. That is something for employers to do. And now Republicans are saying, in effect, that these hard-fought benefits for workers, health care, pensions, the kind that, frankly, only if you're in a union do you get, otherwise you're kind of on your own, that these are things that have to be given up first. I take it you don't agree.
I was going to say, where to start first? The fact that the automakers need to change their agenda, I understand, and I'll accept that in order to get some money. The fact that the employees are somehow to blame for the deterioration of the companies themselves, I think is far, arrived from the actual examples on the ground. And, it has to go back to, as you said, the Great Depression and the origination of the social contract. And I think that companies nowadays have completely, they're off the mark. We, in the 1920s, there was this understanding that you provide for your employees. They give back to you. Productivity will increase. Wages will increase. Society will benefit and the middle class will grow. Ford knew it best. He said, I want a workforce that will be able to buy my own vehicles.
Right, right.
Now, the average Walmart employee can't buy products at the store that they work in. There is something greatly wrong with society. And I think that we need to go back to a social contract of some sort where there is responsibility back on the employer's part. We can't look to that final each and every quarter and making a profit each and every quarter because, that's our whole life at stake.
Sometimes you have long-term things. It's not the fault of an assembly line worker that GM didn't build the hybrid car, that Chrysler didn't develop the fuel cell, that the Japanese and Europeans are doing this with lighter cars that move faster rather, and we're building these SUVs and Hummers.
If I was on the board of half the organizations that we represent was able to, put my 2 cents in on their business plan, I think they they would do better. But that's not the role of the union. The union is to do best by the workers, to provide, you know, good wages and working conditions and benefits to provide for, a living wage to provide for your family.
Let's talk about unions, not necessarily only in the auto context, mm-hmm. although I think it's fair to say that unions in the auto context have provided for their workers much better than workers in a lot of non-union fields. But Barack Obama, our president-elect, yes. was elected with strong support from unions across the nation.
Absolutely.
Many in the primary, virtually everyone, I think, in the general election. And some Republicans are saying, well, now it's payback time. It's time to give the union something. And the main thing that people are talking about is something called the Employee Free Choice Act. Tell us what that is.
The Employee Free Choice is addressing a break in labor law as we know it. It's allowing for workers to be able to join the union through a simple one-step process where if you have 50% plus one of a workplace that wants the union, they sign a union authorization card, mm-hmm. simple piece of paper actually here, mm-hmm. saying, I want representation by a union. You are thereby granted it. What it does is it allows for democracy to be reinstalled back into the workplace, and so people will be given the power of the choice to have a union.
Well, let me ask you this, because obviously people have been unionizing for, I guess, most of American mm-hmm. history. I know back 100 years ago they would use force to break up labor strikes. And if you study American history, you know in the teens, the 20s, there were some really vicious union battles. And then came the National Labor Relations Act. I believe that was Franklin Roosevelt, mm-hmm. right, under that act. And that allows people to join a union and to fight for their wages. Isn't that act enough?
Oh, by far not.
Why not?
What the act originally tried to do is restore the inequalities between companies and with labor and to provide more purchasing power for the average worker. And I think when it's in the Great Depression era, coming out of the 1920s, and the act actually was in 1935, it accomplished a great deal, and there was an understanding that went along with social responsibility and a social contract with your employers. We have gone a great deal further in today's society, where companies are fighting back. They're no longer living up to their end of the bargain, so they are employing union-busting firms, you know, law firms, to go in and basically intimidate, harass, and coerce people to not join the union in the case of a contract campaign to basically stop all contractual measures.
Well, so let me ask you this. So let's say you have an election to join a union. How does it work? People have difficult working conditions. Let's say they have difficult safety conditions in a place, or maybe they don't have health care, adequate health care. And so some of them say, well, maybe if we join in, we can have the kind of bargaining power that the
American people have.
We can join a union. How does a union get formed? Does the management say, form a union? I mean, what happens there?
The process, what we do is we'll get a call often enough into our office, and someone's interested in knowing what the process is to join the union. And it's not something that you hire me and I'm going to make all your worries disappear. The workers in the workplace really do have to step forward. It's something that they have to talk to one another. It is an internal grassroots organizing drive. We assist. We give them all the expertise, you know, having, you know, tried this in rough and tumble ways, to guide them through the process and give them what they need to accomplish it. And we give them those tools. But the workers themselves, you know, through communication,
the workers sign up. A majority has to agree to join the union.
Absolutely.
Or it doesn't happen. They don't get unionized unless a majority agree to join the union.
Absolutely.
And they can do so currently. They can't do so by signing on these cards?
Well, certainly they can.
Oh, they can?
Actually, in the 1930s, the majority of the organizing campaigns, people joined the union strictly through signing up.
Okay.
This is a legally binding piece of paper, and I know a lot of the controversy around the Employee Free Choice Act now is that this is just a piece of paper, and somehow this lacks significance, and that we are taking away from other mechanisms that would benefit.
Contracts are legally significant piece of paper. If you promise to give someone $1 million, that's legally significant. So tell me this. What is the problem? If you can sign up through these cards now, why do you have the Employee Free Choice Act?
The process is, you know, you go into a workplace, people sign up. We can file for an election at 30% of cards. Now, that's quite silly in our, you know, opinion. We won't file for an election until there's, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the workplace is actually signed up.
Why is that?
Well, because the employer typically will not recognize these cards as being representative of the unit themselves.
How can they not recognize the cards? You told me the law said if you have 30%, you get an election.
They could. They could actually say, I recognize that there is 50 percent plus one of my employees that have signed up and they want a union, I will recognize the union today.
Well, so you're telling me the employer governs the election?
The employer can choose to have an election itself. And that's where the complication really does come into play.
Well, explain this to me, because I would think that if 51% sign up, boom, there's a union. And then the union can negotiate and everything. That's not how it works.
Well, absolutely it's the way it happens. But they doubt, perhaps, the legitimacy of the cards. They doubt that actually...
So they would actually go to a worker and say, did you sign this? And you have the whole authority of the boss?
It is illegal for them to specifically ask whether they have signed a card or which way they are voting. However...
But their names are on the card.
Oh, the employer does not get access to these. These are absolutely held in the strictest of confidence by the union.
I see. Okay, well, that's important. For people to know it, so they can't join a union. If they sign up on a card, the employer doesn't get to say, oh, you signed up.
Well, here's where the complication is. We are telling the company that we have 50% plus one, and usually we have 70, 80, or higher percent. And we don't believe you.
Well, you could just take it to a third party.
We want it to go to an election, which all intents and purposes, an election should be... what anyone would want to, if it were free and fair. That's our problem.
So they're not free and fair?
No.
Well, how not?
We did a previous show on this where I played a short little tape. It was by, I believe, Gordon Lafer. He's a professor at the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And what he testified before the Education and Labor Committee of the House is that free and fair, in its strictest of definitions, it has to be your opinion is kept confidential before, during, and after.
In other words, the secret ballot.
You would think so. You go into the little booth, you have the curtain, you draw it, and you put your opinion down, which way you vote in or out of the union, and no one is the wiser. However, as I said before, with these companies hiring these anti-union law firms, they are, in 90% of cases, holding captive audience meetings where they basically intimidate, harass people, pull people to the side.
Captive audience meetings. In other words, they bring the entire workforce into a room and
during
say,
working hours.
During working hours.
Saying,
if you vote for a union, it's going to be terrible, it's going to be awful, it's going to hurt you.
No, they can't say we're going to ship a company overseas. They can allege, too, perhaps this will have a negative consequence to our company.
Okay.
Perhaps you might not get that raise that you were wanting.
So then
perhaps you might not be employed tomorrow.
So then the union simply comes into the same captive audience and says, all right, you've had your 2 hours, it's our turn,
That'd
right?
That would be lovely, but we are denied access to any company facility by law.
Well, wait a minute. The employer can have these captive audience meetings and the unions can't.
Certainly.
So
that
be,
is why the
be,
fundamental
be,
the Labor Relations
kind of like,
Act need to be revised.
It'd be kind of like if Obama and McCain were there, and McCain says, all right, you have no choice. You have to listen to my message for 2 hours, and I will let you listen to Obama's message.
Absolutely.
And that's legal?
It's legal.
Does the Employee Free Choice Act fix that?
What it allows for is, as I said before, 50% plus one of people want to join the union. They sign a legally binding union authorization card. They have to be recognized.
Okay, but why is that the solution to the problem? I mean, why wouldn't the solution to the problem be allow equal access to the union and to management so both can present their case, both with, you know, captive audiences, as you say. If the management has an hour where they give it, equal time. Let the unions have an hour.
I personally would not want any employee to have to go through that. We're not talking about people that can afford to lose their job the next day. We're talking about nurses. We're talking about teachers. We're talking about janitors and people that work in your grocery store. Every hour of their wage is accounted for in their daily budget.
But if they're going to have a captive audience from them, I'm not saying you have to do it.
I would not sacrifice someone to that.
Full time?
We're talking about actually having something that's free and fair. To go back to very rudimental procedures so that we can, you know, beat someone over the head until they see things our way, no, that's not advancing our democratic society.
Let me ask you this. In terms of the cards, the argument is that it's not fair because if you sign a card, then someone can say, well, you know, Joe Smith signed. Why don't you, Mrs. Jones, why don't you sign too? Can the union show...
Oh, the union thug.
Well, look, can the union show one person and say, your friend signed, why don't you sign?
It's never a good procedure to, you know, pit one person against another. This is a legally binding document. I want everyone to understand every application of what this means and what you're signing up for. Because essentially you're signing up for the union to represent you in contract negotiations. It does the union no good to mislead anyone, because trust me, it's the hot topic on the shop
floor. So can the union go and simply say 30% have signed up, 35% have signed up? That you could do. That you'd want to do. Right?
Yeah, and the company could file for an election, certainly.
So
but we will always...
the company files for an election afterwards, and those elections are secret elections.
Well, I mean, secret is a very relative term, as I was saying. The companies actually have a funny way of pulling people in. They hire these, you know, union-busting firms, and in 92% of the times, they have private meetings where they will...
These are the captive meetings you're talking about.
Captive meetings, and then they'll pull people in one by one.
They have one by one.
They
can't ask them how they voted. You said that, right?
Oh, come on. You're smarter than that.
So, in other words, they ask them, and then...
How do you feel about the situation?
Really?
Around the bush. They have a legal system.
Why can't you sue if they do that?
Oh, see, that's the problem with all the labor law. It doesn't matter if it's against the law. It's against the law to fire someone. And 25% of all organizing drives, they fire people.
25% of all organizing drives, they fire people.
So what good does that do to the union? You've already lost. It's going to be your key person that's been pushing on your organizing drive the whole time. You've lost all of your momentum. You've lost all of your credibility.
In other words, they would go in and say, who's the person pushing for the union? Who's that person?
You're looking.
It's Mr. Smith. We'll fire Mr. Smith, and we'll get rid of our union trouble.
So, yeah, certainly.
But if they go and sign the cards, they can do that quietly without anybody finding out, and they can actually get a union without losing their jobs in the process.
Absolutely.
Well, I assure you that management's going to fight this very hard because, you know, they want to be able to spend more money on their corporate jets and not on union health care, right?
Yeah.
Do you expect this to be a big battle?
I think it will be. Because as we've kind of touched on, the way it's being spun in the public media by our opponents is we're taking away the democratic process of a free and fair election.
But is there something wrong with having the election?
It's the timeline. Sometimes it's years before you ever get to that voting booth.
Who decides whether you get to have an election?
Right now, the company.
The company decides?
If they don't recognize that 50% plus one of their workers want a union, it goes to an election.
Wait a minute. So the company decides whether or not an election occurs.
If they refuse to recognize that a majority of their workers have spoken, that of their own free will, the majority has decided they want representation for obviously good reasons.
Well, what if, I mean, how do you know if there's an election at all? I mean, if the company, can the company simply refuse an election?
No. Okay. At that point, it does have to go to an election.
So they do have to go to an election. Mm-hmm. You would show it to some independent authority, a judge or something like that.
Yep.
And then you get
the National Labor Relations Board.
The National Labor Relations Board. What about, I'm just worried about, we're facing a tremendous economic crisis. Barack Obama talked about the fact that a lot of people are going to be fired. In this environment, what can unions do in this terrific, horrible environment to protect workers' rights when all the pressure is going to be on them?
It's all going to be on them. Well, I think it needs to be said that a lot of the problem that we're in right now is because of the decline in union density. It's no irony that...